Hello, everyone. My name is... Fuck, there's nothing anonymous about my recovery. I'm David Johnson. And what's up, man? What's up, fam? And I'm sick and fucking twisted. And that led me to have, I don't know, made a couple of questionable decisions regarding chemicals. But I'm fucking sick and twisted. And, you know, some of you know me, some of you don't. But my name's David Johnson. I'm from Chicago. Some people call me DC. But I think notably, like, Harris County used to refer to me as 01296962. And the state of Texas referred to me as 801851. I've been arrested 49 times. I only know that because on number 48, the Harris County sheriffs that pulled me over were like, and were asking, where's the dope? And didn't believe me when I was like, there is none. They were like, you've been arrested 47 times. And I was like, really? And I know that I got arrested that time, and I got arrested one time after that. So I'm just really trying not to hit the nifty 50. I've been to prison 3 times on 2 sentences. And I'm here before you today. And, you know, for those who can't tell by my voice on the recording of this that Chris has told me he's making, I'm black. So all of that balled up says that I sure as fuck should not be in front of you, but I am. When Chris asked me to tell my story, I was overwhelmed with humility and gratitude because he is someone for whom I have a great deal of respect and I have come to consider a friend and I look to for guidance in moments of what the fuck. And he has proven to be someone that really shows up if you show up. And I think that's just a wonderful place to jump into this, is showing up when someone shows up. Because if you just show up because people ask you to, you'll empty yourself in a minute. I consider myself a member of Austin alumni by 1 degree of separation. I really hope that the board one day, like, institutes some honorary alumni status to avoid me having... Because otherwise, I have to relapse just to be able to come and say I'm a member of alumni. And Kyle's not putting up with that shit. So, look, it started off with a hole. So I was born in Chicago. My father was a pigment of my imagination, didn't come around. Like, I didn't meet my dad until I was 8. And then he said he was going to be right back, and I saw him again when I was 12. Raised by a single mother and by my grandmother as well and my older sister. Grew up in a gang-ridden neighborhood, not the projects, but sure as fuck not the east side. And... you know, it was hard. I was sexually assaulted as a child and wasn't by somebody in my family, but it was by somebody I knew. And by the time I realized it, because it had been suppressed and repressed in my memory, that person was already dead. And so it wasn't like I could have any bit of closure, but that was one fucked up hole. On top of the hole of my dad not being there. So understand, I already felt like I was lacking in some way regarding my masculinity or my masculine identity as far as who I was as a man. Because I didn't have anybody who was supposed to be there showing me, and then someone took some of that away. So while I've never had a homosexual fucking engagement in my life, there was a period in my life where I wondered. Because I never fully felt like I fit in the skin I was in. And straight up, I feel like that's something that everybody in this room can fucking identify with. Something that my wife, Kyle, has said many times. She's like, you know, addiction stems from trauma. We get high or we get loaded because of some trauma. And I feel like, to expand on that, trauma comes from some feeling of lacking that you cannot get rid of. Or the feeling of lacking comes from the trauma, and that shit just goes on and on like a cycle. Always been off the charts, intelligent according to tests and, well, charts. I've also always spoken like this. So imagine a black kid from the south side of Chicago sounding like a white telemarketer. You think I'm joking. Close your eyes for a minute. Please, please. Nobody's going to touch you, or if they do, you'll like it. But close your eyes and imagine this. Hi, my name is David Johnson. I'm calling about my Chase card. It seems that there are some unauthorized purchases. Wasn't there to learn. Nobody really taught me how to fight. I learned how to fight by getting my ass kicked. And I wasn't the greatest student, so I had to study a lot. But the people I grew up with in Chicago, they knew me. And they would tell everybody else, oh, no, that's just how he is. So I always felt like I was special, whether it was for better or for worse. And there was always something going on inside my head that just didn't quite make sense or didn't feel right. I never felt right. Early on, I drank a lot of alcohol because, you know, for those of you who remember that there was a time when you couldn't get alcohol samples in a store. Well, my mom, before that, was giving alcohol samples out in the store, and she would bring home everything that she didn't use. So she, for a woman working three jobs on the south side of Chicago, she had one hell of a stock liquor cabinet. And so, you know, early on, I'm wanting to fit in, so I'm mixing jungle juice. I mean, who the fuck mixes peppermint and banana schnapps with whiskey and thinks it's a drink? But we were getting loaded. And, you know, that was all cool or whatever. Smoke some weed, that was all cool or whatever. Fast forward, I just continued to develop more and more problems. And really, I won't even say develop more and more problems. I developed more symptoms of the same problems that continued to worsen because they were never addressed. Please, oh, please don't let anyone tell you ever that you are problematic or that you have a lot of problems, because really you only have one or two problems. The rest of the shit is just symptoms. You might have 45 fucking symptoms and they might be tired of them, but really it's just a couple of problems. So ended up moving to Houston right before my 15th birthday. Moved to Houston, was one of like, there were never more than five black kids in any of my classes because of the area I moved into. So again, I'm back to not fitting in. Black kids don't want to fuck with me because I don't sound like I'm black. White kids don't want to fuck with me too much because their parents are really not trying to have them bring me home, especially like Jill and Sarah and like, that's a whole nother time to tell my story where we talk about those things. But I got tired of not fitting in. Ended up getting into a fight. I didn't start it, but I finished it. Too bad it was with somebody whose mom worked at the school. So next thing you know, I'm in adaptive behavior classes. I remember sitting in class watching a kid who was functionally illiterate draw the most intricate blueprint of how to hotwire, how to steal a 92 Honda Civic. You could name a year and make model, and he would draw you the diagram of how to steal it. He was like the fucking, he was like the idiot savant. He was the Rain Man of auto theft. But I was in a class with him because they didn't know what to do with this guy. They made me go get diagnosed by the psych provided by the school district. And the psych was like, oh, you know what? You have manic depression or bipolar disorder, and we have the perfect drug for you. We're going to give you Wellbutrin. So, yeah, some people already know how that's wrong. They're like, oh, that's fine. You're a little bit too knowing in this crap. So, for those of you who don't know, it is a common practice that the minute a miracle drug comes out for any kind of disorder or sickness, they prescribe it to everything. So they prescribe me Wellbutrin, and now they know, well, you shouldn't prescribe Wellbutrin to anyone who's manic. So I experienced hypomania. Hypermania. I lost my shit and wanted to die. So here's the thing. So you're supposed to trust doctors, right? Like, right? Or like, motherfuckers are like, oh no. But I like it. I like it a lot. But everybody, as in them people, tell us we're supposed to trust doctors, correct? So when the doctor fucking prescribed something for me and it fucking sent me nuts, I was like, well, fuck. Not only do I distrust everything you've been telling me about what I should take, I distrust everything you're telling me about what I shouldn't do. So within 2 years, I was at U of H on a chemical engineering scholarship, and I was popping MDMA and acid and tooting meth and having a grand old time at raves and at clubs in Houston. And because I don't like spending money on anything, And I'm a natural entrepreneur with the gift of gab. I became a drug dealer. It seemed perfect. Everybody was about peace, love, unity, respect. Everybody was a plur. Everybody was having these wonderful. I was coming up here going to Ohms, which was Red Room, and Proteus, and Area 50. Like, I used to come up here all the fucking time. And my boy had Alien Music. I was getting lit. What? It was going to Austin, San Antonio, Dallas, and Louisiana. Like, we were doing a rave scene. And I made all this money. And I would miss all my classes, but then go get a B on a test. The shit was wonderful. So, you know, they always say when you tell your story to talk about how it was, how it is, like, you know what I'm saying, how it was, what happened, and how it was, it was fucking awesome. It was. And the reason I say that is because I distrust anyone who starts off their story with, it was horrible. Oh, my God, I did a line, and it sucked. If that was the end of your story, you would not be here. Your story went, I did a line, and it was amazing, or I did a line, it sucked, and I called somebody else. Like one of the reasons I consider myself Austin Recovery alumni, one degree of separation, is because it was Kyle that made me think recovery had a chance, gave me a chance. Because the key, I think, for a lot of us is knowing beyond a shadow of a doubt that the person who's it's working for, in our view, the person we see it succeeding for, was as fucked up as we were. And then I get into shit, I meet people like Chris, and I'm like, oh, there's no fucking doubt he's partied as hard as I have. I can't even. Like, shit, I remember trying to come and see you back in the day once, and I didn't have tickets. Like, it's fucked up. So, it was fun. Until it wasn't. And that sounds real simple. It was fun until it wasn't. But no, it was fucking rocking and rolling and awesomeness and rainbows and unicorns and licorice dolphins and all that great shit. And then I realized one day, oh my God, I'm not going to beat this case. Fuck, and I've been going to court for 7 months. Shit, I wasn't going to beat this case ever. I've been delusional as fuck. So, you know, I'd love to, you know, when I first started telling my story, and so y'all know, I hit 22 months yesterday. And I remember thinking that when you tell your story, people are like, you know, no war stories. And I'm like, but I'm a veteran. You haven't seen, look at the camo. You haven't seen the things I've seen. They were, and I was running, and they were like, and no, fuck that. Everybody likes to think that their shit is special as fuck. I don't give a fuck if it's got pixie dust on it or if there's a giant colored sparkler sticking out of it. Your pile of shit smells like shit. You know, straight up. Like, I've been picking up dog shit all week while my baby's been in Costa Rica. Dog shit, no matter what it looks like, all smells pretty similar. And then you take a shit yourself and you're like, mammals, I get it. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's shit. And so I understand the reason why people say don't get into all the glam and bam of what you used to do, because we would be here all day until somebody would want to go out and be out all night. I went to prison and ended up doing, well, I did 10 months, right? Got out on shock probation. Then woke up a year later, handcuffed to a gurney in Ben Taub Hospital in Houston. All I knew was I fell asleep taking a piss. To this day, people are like, dude, did you get caught jacking off? I'm like, no. First off, masturbation is not something you get caught doing. That's something pride. Secondly, I fell asleep taking a piss. They can call it what they want. And so they violated my probation, and I did the next 50 months in custody. And I went to a unit called Ferguson Unit because of a staff assault case that I didn't do. And I watched people die in Ferguson. So I watched people die in the streets. I didn't watch a whole lot of people die in the club scene because I mean, there were a couple, but it was like a random, oh, damn, that's fucked up. But, you know, wasn't really a bunch of shit people were ODing on. You got to go real hard to OD on coke. Opiates and opioids, you don't really have to try that hard. You kind of look at it the wrong way and you OD. But, like, coke, motherfuckers got to go real hard. And meth, you overamp and pass out before that ever happens. Like, I've seen people OD on weed before. But I saw people die in prison, and it really fucked with me. Because you could go to prison for a DWI and never make it home. Funny, though, didn't fuck with me enough to get me to stop getting high. So, I got out of prison and applied for jobs and didn't get any of them because I was a convicted felon. So what the fuck was I going to go back to doing? Any guesses? How dare you make me feel like a cliche? So, had to do something. So I was going to make a move, and I knew how to make moves. And, whoo, it was on and popping like Orville Redenbacher until it wasn't. And I was back in prison. So I got out of prison, and I was getting high again and moving shit because I just don't know how to get high without moving shit. I'm addicted to power more than I've ever been addicted to a chemical. That's not to say I'm not addicted to chemicals, but the power is the shit that got me first. Being able to get into anywhere without paying, getting backstage to any show, having the top flight, top of the world, Craig, top flight everything. That shit was addicting to me. Being the go-to, everybody want to be on your good side because they sure as fuck didn't want to be on your foul side. That shit, that was more intoxicating, and that gave me a greater high than any chemical compound on God's earth. And it took me a long time to realize that that wasn't the only one, because I realized that kind of early on, but then I was in delusion about the other shit. So one day while I was high as fuck at somebody's apartment, this beautiful angel walked in to drop off dope. And we were married like a year and a half later. And that is the most amazing blessing in my life that was the stupidest thing either one of us ever did. What the fuck do two active meth addicts, dealers, have anything? What the fuck are they doing getting together? It was like some fucked up sitcom. She's never been arrested. She works for a law firm. He's a felon and black. The fuck? Like, but I'd be dead if I never met her. I mean, short of a miracle, other than the miracle God has already given me, I would be dead if it were not for meeting her. And hell, she may think the same thing about me, but, you know, probably in five different other ways. And our marriage was topsy fucking turvy. Like, both ways, emotional abuse, physical abuse, fucking. One thing I can say is she was far more scared of me than I was ever of her. And I didn't even know it because I didn't really think of myself as a scary person. Because on the real, I was always trying to make people think I was scary. But I never stopped being that little kid who was getting his ass kicked after being touched by some fucking guy back in Chicago. But how was she supposed to know that? So after all kind of lies and some infidelity on my part and just all kind of bullshit, like physical infidelity, emotional infidelity, but, you know, really, we like to say they're the same, but they're not. But I will say this for anyone who likes to jump and go, girl, if once a cheater, always a cheater, fuck you. No, I mean that because I find it reprehensible to hear people in such a cavalier fashion discard the potential for any individual to grow beyond their past behaviors, to overcome their past mistakes, all the while they're standing trying to be seen beyond some felony conviction or some OD that they had last month, year, fucking decade. But If once a cheater, always a cheater, but only when it's a guy. Fuck that. Because I cheated on my wife. I did. I say it not to rub her nose in it. I say it so that I don't run and hide from it. And I say it to make it a testament to the level, to the extent, the depth of, and the breadth of her recovery, because she has a sense of forgiveness that has taught me more than I could ever help to teach, ever hope to teach anyone else, or ever help anyone else to learn. But I think the key was that she made me do something different before she believed shit about what I was saying. But we'll get to that. So I she came to me at Harris County and told me, I can't do this anymore. I'm done. When one meth dealer tells another meth dealer, you are too dishonest for me. All kind of red flags should go up. But of course, I'm Chris. I'm on the other side of bulletproof glass going, no, they're lying, man. It's not true. Ah! Here's the thing. One, they were lying. Two, I had no right to expect her to believe me. Once you've lied to someone chronically or habitually, they owe you no fucking consideration with regard to bonding you to the truth until you've done something differently. So she left. Got with somebody else, went and got, did start, and kept doing what we had been doing. And I will say she at least helped me get into a program, because there are two things that I did before I got into recovery that I think were like key to me being this wonderfully cured example. I went to Passages, you know, right here, you know. I'm PAX, you know. Example of chocolicity right here. So one was there was this program called the Dual Diagnosis Residential Program in Harris County, and it was supposed to be for dual diagnosis, mental illness and co-occurring substance use, but it didn't really fuck with substance use at all, and there was no 12-step short of like a loose informal group that like somebody started. And I understand, I didn't know anything about 12-step except that whenever I was sent there on parole or probation, I usually ran into people I did business with, and we ended up doing more business. That's how I knew, like, that's what I knew about 12-step groups in Houston. And anybody who's been down in Houston understands the Houston recovery scene is not what the Austin recovery scene is. So, but what it did teach me was it taught me about, you know, I know a lot of you have heard, like, CBI and CBT, you know. Well, I didn't know about, I mean, I had heard of it, you know. Like kind of like a fairy tale, like, you know, like the guy who didn't wear protection at the bathhouse but never got a disease. I heard about people like that, you know, but did they really exist? Like the person who never missed, what do they, I heard about that person. So, but I experienced it, and it taught me about the need to change my thoughts and the need to change my way of thinking. And I never forgot the lessons I learned in that program, even though while, when I got on probation, I started drinking, because I was just like, oh, well, my issue is with meth, but I'm good drinking. I started working. I went back to culinary and was working at this high-end restaurant, which all of you have ever, any of you have ever worked in a restaurant or in the hospitality industry know, that's safe as fuck for somebody in an early, like, trying to stay clean on probation. Yeah, like, look here, I was hired in giraffe ass. Real fucking talk. I like, because I don't like getting drunk unless I'm going to sleep. Like, I get drunk, I'm like, yay! I don't like to drive. I just want to go lay down, maybe fall asleep inside you. That's about it. But I get drunk, and I'm out with the rest of the restaurant, and these motherfuckers are like, we're going to go for 3 more hours. I swear to you, I don't know. Well, I know how it happened, but I was getting drunk, and then I had a half ounce of meth in my pocket. And I had to go into the bathroom and go through my phone and backtrack to see how it transpired. Like, I blacked out. My mind blacked out just so I could go score. That's some sick shit. I didn't think that then. I thought, well, I'm pretty, I'm bad, I'm cold. And, I'm like, yeah. And so I violated probation. And went back to this place for 6 weeks. But they told me, they were just like, we just need to give you a refresher because you already know what the fuck to do. You're not like these other people that don't know. You have these tools. And it's funny because I know y'all heard that you have these tools, and that's some shit we hear a lot today. All that while, my wife was here in Austin, and she was at AR, and I would come visit her here, and I remember coming out here and sitting with her at the tables, and I remember our son playing on the basketball court. And then she went to Oxford House, and I remember coming and seeing her there. But I didn't remember other things. Like, she let me know recently that, like, I helped pay for her Oxford House. I didn't remember that. Sounds like some shit I do, because I knew it was in the best interest of our kid that she'd be okay. But, like, I was like, really? And it wasn't even like I did it because I was high. It was just like, I don't think about that shit. I don't. Like, when I'm not in the midst of selling dope, I'm not really worried about the money. And I'm glad, because shit, when you're not selling dope, you really don't have a bunch of it. But you're okay with it. So the second thing I did that really laid the foundation for my recovery was I went to this thing called the Mankind Project. And it was the second pivotal half of my foundation to go with the whole like awareness of thinking differently and everything, because it really tuned me into the concept that there is a dark shadow, like parallel existence of mine that I run from, and thus that I let lead my existence. And shit, I was like high 2 days before I went to that thing, and I wasn't supposed to be. So it got real intense, like, whoa, people are like, you see things? Fuck yeah. Uh-oh. So, I still wasn't done, though, because that was just the foundation. And I wanted to point that out because I know for a lot of you, you've been through the ringer 3, 4, 5, 6, 87 times. Some of you will get it the first time. And when I first got into recovery, I used to be kind of fucking weird looking at people and be like, why are they relapsing? Don't they know? Man, if God hadn't seen fit to have those two pieces of my foundation put in place, I would probably be shooting dope right now. So any one of those little things changes, and this 22 months is more like 18 minutes or 25 years. But I wasn't done yet because I was still studying. I'm writing a book, y'all. So I ended up what I call the meth trap house, the $400,000 meth trap house. My friend worked for the hospital, and we'd known each other for a while. And so he had a 5-bedroom house in Cypress, Texas. And shit got weird. Like, I'm in boxer shorts with a gun and a $20 telescope looking through the blinds, watching us under surveillance. There's a CVS at the front of the neighborhood, Fairfield and Cypress. And I remember walking out and going to CVS and stopping by the car and, you need anything? I'm going to go get some coffee. What? You don't? Hey, like, and this is what people don't get. They go, oh, you were just high. No. When you knock on their window and they refuse to look at you, it's not you imagining shit. But you sure as fuck do light that fire under them to make sure something happens fast. And I kept telling them, oh man, we're under surveillance. I'm so paranoid, I can't even sell dope. There's plenty of it, but I can't sell any. I'm not really getting high anymore. I'm stuck. What do I do? I don't have a car. I can't walk anywhere. What the fuck am I going to do? And everybody's like, don't get David high. Don't get DC. Don't get DC high. He'll kill your buzz. You know, he gonna get paranoid. Don't fuck with him. Until the day all the police showed up at the house. Now, what y'all don't understand is I've been talking to my wife this whole time. Now, I was calling her my wife. She was calling me Elias's father. But I was talking to her regularly. And we disagree. I said for about 2 weeks. She said for about 6 months. You know, tomato, tomato. But, like, I had called her and told her I'm done. Because I did this whole thing where I shot a bunch of dope and I didn't feel anything. And I couldn't understand why. And then I realized I was spiritually dying. And someone once asked me, what does spiritual death feel like? And I said, that's the thing. It feels like absolute emptiness. And when they asked me, what did it mean to you? What it meant to me was that, oh shit, this is something I can't come back from. And I realized I hadn't been afraid of physically dying in over 20 years. But man, I've been afraid as fuck of living. And Kyle seemed to be having this really wonderful life without me, away from Houston. So I called her and I asked her if she could help me, if she knew anybody that could help get me in somewhere. And so I'm in Houston trying to figure out a way to work the system to be in Houston, but get into OSAR to get to here, because I know it worked. And I remember she told me, she's like, hey, the Salvi has a six-month program. And I was like, fuck that. If I do 6 months, it's for a case. And, you know, some people might hear that and think, oh, well, your pride. You know what? That was me being real as fuck. It's a lot better than me saying, yeah, let's do that. And I get up here and I bounce out. I knew I wasn't staying for a six-month program. I knew it. And she talked to somebody in the recovery circle who talked to someone, and I ended up at a place right down the road called Solstice. And I have since realized that the only two places I would have gotten clean in Austin were AR or Solstice. Because it had to be someplace that wasn't afraid of me or my bullshit. And someplace that wasn't afraid to make me feel as common as I actually am. Because once you've been running through the world for 20-something years as this fucking black unicorn, it feeds your ego to this point that you tell yourself nobody can understand what you've gone through. Nobody can understand anything about you. And it insulates you. It builds this bullshit wall of solidified emotional fecal matter and spiritual fucking feces so that nothing worthwhile can get through. And all that shit had to get peeled down. But I came into it, I like to say, because my son needed me, but I stayed because I needed me. So I like to also say, anyone who tells you you can't do this for anyone else, they're partially right. You can't stay in it for anyone else. You can sure as fuck start it for someone else. So what does this recovery thing look like now for me? It looks like me looking over at my wife every few minutes because I love her so much. And because it's okay for me to depend on her to tell me I'm completely out of fucking line. Because I truly understand why someone who loves their partner refers to them as their better half. I'm creeping up on 2 years, and, you know, I look out here and I look at people in this room that I've been in treatment with, people that I've lived in sober living in Oxford House with, and in other sober living with, and I'm overwhelmed with a truly accurate sense of just how small I am. And that's the greatest feeling ever. I'd rather really recognize how small I am in the scope of the grandiosity that is God than be completely off base in thinking I'm the shit. One of the things that I would always say when I was getting high was that, man, one day I want to have enough wealth. I want to be in a position to really help people. I want to found a nonprofit. I want to learn what it takes to start a nonprofit. You know what? One day I was tired of working at the software company that I was working for. Yeah, me, Mr. Super Felon, working at a software company again. And I just got off a phone interview with another software company and was like, you know, dude, this is awesome. And went on the phone and saw that this organization that you know, I like on Facebook and I get their media feed, had this fellowship opening for a criminal justice organizer. And I read the description and it said looking for someone that has lived experience in the criminal justice system and lived experience with mental health hospitalization. And the way that translated to me was, and I shall use my Leon Phelps voice, what that means, sweet thing, is that we looking for somebody who has been locked up and has been hospitalized because you are what they call crazy as fuck. I had to read that shit twice because there's no way that there's a job. Like, if it said, and you must be able to play guitar or bass, I'd be like, oh, that's a band. But no, this shit was like a real legit job. Excellent benefits. I was like, what the fuck? So what do I do today? I found a way to get paid spending all my time trying to help change the criminal justice system. And that is some shit that was completely off my scope of reality. Like, reality for me was, I'm a felon. I don't even refer to myself as that anymore. Don't let the labels beat you down. I'm a formerly incarcerated person. I served my time, so my rights should be fully restored. I get to have talks like this just because I keep putting one foot in front of the other and keep doing the next right thing. It's not easy if you look at it by itself. If you look at it compared to all the shit that I've ever done, it's easy as fuck. So everybody that likes to talk that shit about how recovery, you know, it's hard one day. Big picture, it is not hard. It isn't. It may feel hard in the moment, but compared to all the fucking high-speed chases in rental cars. Ask Kyle about the Nissan Murano. And all the indictments and the surveillance and the multiple different federal indictments that we somehow didn't end up on. And not killing yourself and not killing your kids. And somehow, despite all the wrong that you did as a parent or as a spouse, realizing that you have not ruined the other person for time immemorial. And that, hey, when you finally decide to get your head out of your ass, most, not all, but most of the people that ever mattered will show back up one day because all they've been doing is waiting in the background for you to fucking get your head out of your ass. So, like, I can sit here and tell you, yeah, man, it's hard. It's as hard as it is to not get high. And some days that's harder than others. Some days it's harder to drink than others. But for me, I don't ever want to start over. And I hope that my choice to give myself over completely to the perfection of my imperfect existence and his purpose for me, which is the one perfect thing I have going, I hope that it in some way, shape, or form helps somebody. Because Kyle's a perfect example. It may not just be about you. It may be about the person you saved through the example you set for them. And for that example that she set for me, I will be eternally grateful to Austin Recovery. Thank you.